Well, hey, everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am very privileged to have back in the studio in the flesh, Tim Gegline. Tim, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Well, you've officially graduated. Well, you've done one other culture segment with us, but you were on a roundtable.
Yes,
as
indeed.
Well.
That's
so
right.
This is your third interview with us.
And as I understand, Lisa, the third time is a charm. So at least this time, I hope to get it right.
Well, no, you contributed well in the previous times. And I will tell people to go and search Tim's name on our site and you can find some of the things he talked about previously. I just jokingly told him before we started recording here that we're going to be talking about elements of his life. So hopefully he prepared and studied ahead of time so he knows what to talk about here. But many of you know, if you listen to the show and if you're familiar with Focus on the Family, that Tim is now our Vice President of External Relations here at Focus, which means that he basically hangs out in Washington, D.C. and hobnobs with important people and represents Focus to them, which is kind of a reciprocal job from what you had previously.
Exactly. For those who don't know, I have written a memoir called The Man in the Middle, and the subtitle is An Inside Account of Faith and Politics in the George W. Bush Era. And the reason I say that, Lisa, is because in the nearly 8 years that I was working with and for President Bush, I was offered a very long title, which was a special assistant to the president and the deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. And when Karl Rove, who wrote the foreword to the book, offered that position to me in behalf of the president, I said, can you translate that into the English language? And he said, it means you'll be the man in the middle. You will be the president's point man to your fellow Christians and conservatives. And I say that because in a way that I never would have expected or anticipated, you're right. That kind of model is very close to what I do with and for Focus on the Family in Washington. I'm Focus's eyes and ears in Washington and our ambassador to the most powerful city in the world.
Yeah. And I love how you jokingly say in the book that the longer the title you had in Washington, the less influence you had.
Yes,
so I guess
yes.
President, you're pretty important. You know,
Senator,
if you have to explain
Congressman, exactly. Justice, yes, exactly.
Oh, well, you know, I was in D.C. as well. I was there at the Washington Times, and I can't even remember what my title was. So I'm sure that's not the best.
It shows how powerful you actually
right.
were.
That must have been it. That must have been it. As I was shuffling papers and sending emails. So, well, okay, this is an interesting journey that we're going to be talking about, and you did reference the book. And I want to start out, Tim, by talking about you growing up, because you talk about being a product of the 70s and 80s, but as I was reading your story, when most of us were playing Pac-Man and watching MTV, you were basically reading the Constitution and the Federalist Papers, and you were getting into all elements of culture. And I'm going to be honest, that's just kind of weird.
I can honestly say that I was and am a nerd. And in fact, as I recount in the book, I was born in 1964, which is the last year of the baby boom. And I remember very clearly on most summer evenings when I'd be playing in the backyard, my mother or father would call me just before 5:30 and tell me to come in because Walter Cronkite was on. And I'd go in and watch the CBS Evening News. The reason I'm saying that, and presumably the reason you asked me, is because when I was young and when I was growing up in the Midwest, there does come that moment. And I think it's true for most children, even the ones who don't come in to watch Walter Cronkite, but who stay and play kickball and baseball and whatever. But elementally, there's all kinds of things that are forming who you are and what you're interested in. And I'm quite certain that I couldn't have said as a young boy, what I'm interested in is that matrix of where policy, politics, and the press overlap. Even though I couldn't have said it then, I think all of the foundations or antecedents, as they say, were coming together. And as I was growing up, those are the things, current events, what was in the news, history, culture, the arts, politics, those things were important to me. Although I will say this, I always loved baseball and tennis. And I don't know if most nerds do, but I certainly did and do with a passion.
Yeah. Well, and it's so interesting because you were starting to follow just culture and politics and all that, you know, growing up in Indiana. I mean, it's not like you were a Kennedy. It's not like you had, you know, you walked the halls of all these people that had served in different offices or whatever. So it really was something born out of what you believed. You know, you kind of probably had an inkling of who we were as a nation just by observing your family and just honest, hardworking people, and understanding that a lot of those ideals were something that probably were part and parcel of something bigger than themselves.
Yes. I was very fortunate to grow up in a home where there was never a single second of a doubt that my mother and father were crazy about one another. That really helps as a little person. Mm-hmm. My father, who is my best friend, as I recount in my book, next to my wife, was entrepreneurial, business-oriented, a small businessman, self-made. My mother, like my father, never went to college until many years later. She went back to college, as I recount in the book. But my mother, I hate to say that she was intellectually curious, because that sounds like she was elevated. She wasn't. But my mother is the one who introduced me to classical music, introduced me to jazz, who introduced me to really good novels, who taught me to be really curious about things worth being curious about. My father always loved history. My father loved animals. My father loved sports. So, you know, when you're a little person and you're absorbing all this, you know, you're being shaped and formed in a certain way. But you're right. For most of the kids that I grew up with in a decidedly middle-class part of the middle of America, most people were not overwhelmingly interested in many of the things that were becoming interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty fun. Well, I think it's just, it's a fascinating story, and folks are going to have to get the book to get the full account of this. But basically, in a nutshell, you were offered an internship, basically with Dan Quayle. You did that for a summer, the kind of your third taste of Washington, D.C. You'd gone once as a family and then once with school, but you were back now and you were officially going to live there for a summer and be part of it. Then you returned actually on staff, or you had the opportunity to go work for Dan Coats, and you did that. And really, that was a very defining, you define him or describe him as one of really your most influential people and a great friend, someone that has really influenced you. And then a season with Dan Coats, a long season, and then you were on Gary Bauer's campaign. We all know Gary Bauer here at Focus on the Family through his work with the Family Research Council. And all of a sudden, you find yourself on the campaign of this guy named George W. Bush. Now, had you anticipated this? I mean, I know you didn't anticipate that first internship, but was this something that you felt was snowballing, Tim? And you just, because I know you wanted, you really were interested in broadcast journalism, and it's kind of like you never quite, you would try to pull yourself into it and you'd get pulled out back over to D.C. So what really defines kind of that era of your life?
What defined that era was actually going to Washington two summers, as you describe, as an intern. And for the first time, meeting all the other nerds. Some were liberal, some were Democrats, some were conservative, some were Republicans. I met a lot of people who loved art and music and who loved tennis, like me. And I realized that I was meeting this whole group of people who eventually wanted to work in journalism, who wanted to work in public policy, who wanted to work in think tanks, who weren't embarrassed when you said, what's your opinion of World War II or the Civil War, or, you know, did Abraham Lincoln win the Lincoln-Douglas debates, you know? And as a young man, that was very exciting to me. But as you describe, after 10 years in the Senate, working for Dan Coats, after working for Gary Bauer, I decided by and large that I was mostly done with politics. And I went to see Dan Coats, and he said, you're making a big mistake. You really should work on at least one presidential campaign. And I worked on Gary Bauer's campaign. And after Gary flamed out, after doing a great job, a really great job through all those debates in 2000, to answer specifically your question, I was at the Philadelphia Convention when George W. Bush was formally nominated. I saw Karen Hughes in an elevator by happenstance. And she said to me, I think we want to get you on board. And I had no idea what she was talking about. And within a few weeks, her deputy called me. And within 2 weeks after that, my wife and I and our two boys were driving in our Dodge Caravan to Austin, Texas. We joined the Bush for President campaign. I was 32 days in Florida during Bush versus Gore. We won. I thought I was going to be offered a job in the White House press office. And out of a clear blue sky, Karl Rove called me. And as I recount in the book, he said, Tim, I'm calling to change your life. And he did.
And he did. And I love one thing that you share in the book is just kind of that anticlimactic season of the Florida ballot count. And you were sitting there in Florida and you felt, you know, at first it was, Gore called and conceded and then he retracted. And then you're just sitting there and you're like, there wasn't really any fanfare because everyone had to go to bed and no one knew what was decided. And you said you actually describe going to Epcot in that season and really having a jolt of what it felt like to be among real people who weren't obsessed with hanging chads and everything else that was going on.
I'm actually really glad you asked that question because in this book, I wanted to give sort of a series of snapshots of what these things actually felt like. And only one time in 32 days in Florida, being in nine different cities, only one time did we have half a day off. And we went to Epcot. And I remember being at Epcot on this beautiful day, watching families walk around together. And you know, Lisa, at this point, I had not seen my family in several weeks. And I thought, my gosh, why are they not as obsessed, you know, with this with this election as everybody else is? And mm-hmm. I realized, no, normality actually now was residing in a different spot. And of course, we were exhausted. A big night of sleep was 3 hours.
Yeah. And I really love, Tim, how you describe, there's a section of the book where you're talking about just feeling a little disillusioned with that and feeling like, I think your folks were in Pennsylvania celebrating Thanksgiving and your family was in Texas and here you were in Florida. And you said your dad talked to you on the phone and he said, "Remember, Tim, there's a purpose in all of this. We are praying for you. Don't lose your optimism. It will all work out. Be thankful to God for this. He will give you peace." And then you describe later on in the paragraph, you say, "Carpe diem for me was to be Christ-centered despite the outcome."
Yes.
And I see that as so such an interesting point to make, especially to an audience of young adults who feel like a lot of times we're caught up in the churn, whether we're in a job we don't like, whether we feel like we wish we would have planned something else, but here we are doing this, or feeling disillusioned about our upbringing versus where we are now. Mm. And did you see that? I mean, because you were, you know, young. I mean, you know, young dad with two kids. As far as just feeling like that giving you a sense of, okay, I can move forward from here?
Two comments. First, your question is very perceptive. Point one, I never thought I would be near to 40 years old or my late 30s needing the validation and help of my dad. Hmm. But I did. Mm-hmm. I really felt despair. As you know from the description of the book, to cheer us up on Thanksgiving Day, they brought in Wayne Newton, you know, and nobody in the room knew who Wayne Newton was.
Yeah.
And then he sang his quote-unquote signature song and promptly forgot the words, and I thought, I'm out of here, you know. And I go back to my hotel room feeling this great sense of despair. And in the Christian life, despair is a sin. Mm-hmm. And my father reminded me of that. And frankly, after that phone call, which was really pivotal, I never felt it again. I felt that win, lose, or draw, this is where I'm supposed to be. And it really impacted my life in a very significant way. The second comment is the famous novelist Virginia Woolf famously turned, she was British, and she turned to a young Brit, and she once said, "What does it feel like to be young?" You know, and this goes to the heart of your question. I know I'm talking to thousands of people who have a difficult time, as we all do, but particularly when you're young, these are very large questions, and you're trying to figure it all out. And sometimes you need the reality check of one other person, presumably a Christian, who can help say, just remember, first principles exist, God is sovereign, He's in charge, and all shall be well. And sometimes we just need to hear that from one other person.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned here that Karl Rove gave you a call and basically asked you a question that changed your life. That question led to you actually having a full-time position in the George W. Bush White House. And I just want to focus on that era for a little bit here, because really much of the focus of this book is you talking about President Bush as we, many of us, did not know him. What we knew came off of whether it was CNN or Fox News or the networks, you know, trying to get bits and pieces, glimpses here. But you walked into an office every day and basically dealt with things that he was ordering directly. So, and one of the pivotal moments of that on the front end of his presidency was 9/11. And you devote a chapter to that and really what happened there. And really in the wake of that, describe Bush's presidency as a war presidency. And you say no president, except possibly Teddy Roosevelt, wanted to be considered a war president.
That's right.
How do you think that really shaped President Bush going in and really a year later recognizing, oh my word, here I am, and this is probably going to define where I go from here?
You know, Lisa, if you go back to the first inaugural address that President Bush delivered, he's one of the few presidents ever to put the centerpiece of his speech in a parable, which he does in the parable of the Good Samaritan. And if you read that speech, as I have, it's really a beautiful speech. It's really a peace and prosperity speech. You know, a two-term Texas governor is coming to Washington following the difficulties of the Clinton-Gore presidency. And it's really quite a idyllic description. Within a year, as you say, and I write about this in a chapter called Lightning Out of a Clear Blue Sky, which is the Pearl Harbor of our generation, 9/11. I was in the White House that day. And to answer your question, Lisa, very directly, I watched a peace and prosperity two-term governor become a war president. That was a remarkable thing to watch. I'm quite certain in my professional life, you know, short of scaling Mount McKinley or something, I'll never see anything like that again. It was really a remarkable thing. Because I was Karl Rove's deputy, I spent a lot of time at close range with the president. I prayed with the president. I got to know him. And I got to see him, what he was like when, you know, the doors were closed and the lights were off and the cameras were not worrying for the next news conference, you know. And I found two things. I found that George W. Bush was the same in private as he is in public. That's very rare in Washington. And one of the things that I love about George W. Bush. Also, and most importantly, and this is, I think, the most important thing I can say on Boundless, George W. Bush's presidency cannot be understood separate from his Christianity. I believe that the revisionist history, in the best sense, is just starting in the Bush presidency, because we have now the benefit of time and a little distance. And my book is the first book to be written, not as a biography, not as a history, but as a political memoir, because I came to see that if you are someone like Karl Rove or Condi Rice or Don Rumsfeld or you know, the vice president, Dick Cheney, who've all written memoirs, you're so close to the power that you don't see things. But those of us like me who were not the senior most people, we were not the confidants. We had a bit of a distance, but we still saw a lot of things. So I wanted to take people into the Oval Office, onto Air Force One. I wanted them to, you know, come along on the South Lawn for big things that we had to do. And in the 9/14 service at the National Cathedral, actually be there for how that service came together. But all from a perspective of the biggest thing that George W. Bush and I share in common, mm-hmm. which is our love for Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. And I know that throughout the book, especially when you're detailing your time in the White House, you talk about how it was really his intent to constantly bring back his faith-based agenda. And even though people tried to define him in other ways and people tried to constantly hinge on this or that policy or get back to 9/11, you know, he would always mention it first or second as really one of his primary priorities. When we look, Tim, you know, we'll often try to define presidents by a few things, you know, and, you know, taking Reagan as an example, we think of the Berlin Wall, we think of Challenger, we think of taxes. What would you say, you know, in giving, if you were introducing President George W. Bush and mm-hmm. you could define his presidency by a few things, what would you say they are? And probably overlook things mm-hmm. in some ways.
Several things. I take the reader back to the first major Iowa debates when all the candidates were asked, and I was there that night, who's your favorite philosopher? And he said, Jesus Christ, because he changed my life. That is a defining moment for George W. Bush. It was his way of saying, I'm not afraid to let people know that Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior. I was really touched by that when that happened, and I think millions of people were. By the way, in the room where I was watching the debate in Iowa, there was an audible gasp. I think that when he ascended the pulpit at National Cathedral on the same day as Billy Graham, and he spoke about the exceptional, exemplary nature of the United States and our role as the beacons of freedom. I think his passion for the innocent preborn. You know, George W. Bush always said the line that Father Newhouse famously said, that eventually America would be a place where every child would be welcomed into the world and protected by the law. That's the ultimate pro-life statement from a president. George W. Bush will be remembered as the most pro-life, pro-marriage, pro-family, pro-religious liberty, individual conscience president of any of the contemporary presidencies. And it wasn't just words, it was actions. It was elevating to the highest court in the United States justices who share the president's view. And this is very important.
Mm-hmm. Wow. A day in the life of the president. What did that look like when there weren't wars to worry about and there wasn't craziness and there wasn't speech? You know, obviously, probably every day had a speech. But what did he do from day to day for the most part, as you saw?
He began every single day early. He's an early riser. He began his day with the First Lady because they knew that if they didn't have time together in the morning, the day would be disparate. So I love the fact that they would have breakfast together, have coffee together, etc. But every single day for George W. Bush began with reading his Bible, reading devotions, and in prayer. And I took great heart from that. Hmm. But frankly, every single day when you're president of the United States, for all the order that a very talented staff seeks to impose in your life, and George W. Bush is a person who likes order. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's never late. He's always early or exactly on time. He's very mindful of other people. If he meets a pope, a queen, a king, a president, a prime minister, or he meets the man or woman on the street or a junior staffer, he's a person of great magnanimity, and everybody is the same in his eyes. That, I think, also springs from his faith. But for George W. Bush, it was, to use his Texas phrase, getting at it. It was a very busy day of travel, of speeches, of major decisions, every single day, 7 days a week. There's never a day when you're the president that the most important things, the most important, do not come across your desk. And the thing that I'm very eager to leave with the boundless listener is the following, that it is a dispiriting, difficult reality that when you're the president of the United States, you learn often of all the people and all the schemes and all the tactics and all the strategies who, if these so-called people had the ability, would push the proverbial button and blow us to kingdom come. And what you learn when you're at the White House is that the terrorists or the people who mean us harm, they can make lots of mistakes. But when you're the leader of the free world, when you are the president of the United States, your first obligation is the safety of the people. And so I think that every single day of George W. Bush's presidency, particularly after 9/11, was preventing another attack on our domestic soil. And I think overwhelmingly, that's the greatest achievement of the Bush presidency. This, by the way, I think will grow over time.
Hmm. And in what way, Tim, do you think he was most misunderstood? I mean, did he even follow all the comedians that lampooned him? I mean, our generation, it's like it's hard to even think of President Bush without thinking of Will Ferrell or without thinking mm-hmm. of... So yeah. All the crazy things that were said about him, what was most misunderstood?
Well, he is a person of great humor. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, mostly he was, as you well know from his public comments, he was good about laughing at himself. Mm-hmm. You know, in this, he shared this in common with Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And he has President Bush has a great sense of humor. And so does the First Lady, former First Lady, who, by the way, is a person of great elegance, panache. I think she's a really a remarkable person. But yes, the president does pay attention. But there's a difference between a president who pays attention and a president who's preoccupied. And the president was not preoccupied by what other people said or thought. He was willing, and I think that this redounds to his benefit, he was willing to be unpopular because he had to make decisions that were unpopular. When you're organizing 22 agencies of the federal government, in the biggest reorganization since World War II, you step on a lot of toes. You don't intend to do that, but ultimately that's what you do. And I believe that it's true that George W. Bush in the contemporary presidency left the presidency unpopular. But I think he left the presidency unpopular rooted in principle, not because of his decision-making capacities, which I think is very high and I think grows over time.